This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company. For more information and links to all our great podcasts, visit hartmanmedia.com.
Welcome to the Holistic Survival Show with Jason Hartman. The economic storm brewing around the world is set to spill into all aspects of our lives. Are you prepared? Where are you going to turn for the critical life skills necessary to survive and prosper? The Holistic Survival Show is your family's insurance for a better life. Jason will teach you to think independently, to understand threats, and how to create the ultimate action plan. Sudden change or worst case scenario, you'll be ready. Welcome to Holistic Survival, your key resource for protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Ladies and gentlemen, your host, Jason Hartman.
It's my pleasure to welcome Kevin Ring. He is Director of Strategic Initiatives for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, otherwise known as FAM, former counsel of the Senate Judiciary Committee's Constitution, Federalism, and Property Rights Subcommittee. He's a former lobbyist and associate to Jack Abramoff. That's a name you've certainly heard, and we'll talk about that. He was in that position during the Abramoff Indian lobbying and bribing scandal. He's author of Scalia Dissents, Writings of the Supreme Court's Wittiest, Most Outspoken Justice. Kevin, welcome. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Good. Tell the listeners, who is Jack Abramoff and how did that lead to you spending some time in prison?
Jack Abramoff was a well-known lobbyist in Washington, D.C. in the 1990s. He started in the 1990s after the Republicans took control of Congress in 1994. There were a lot of Democrats in the city, and there weren't as many conservative Republicans, especially on K Street, which is shorthand for the lobbying world. And Abramoff came to town and developed a reputation as this sort of swashbuckling super lobbyist. I was working on the Hill at the time in the House of Representatives and then again in the Senate while going to law school at night and getting my degree. And when I finished, I decided to go work for Jack Abramoff, which for a lot of young conservative Republicans was sort of the top spot to go to because he was killing it in terms of revenue and clients and sort of exposure. He had become one of the top five lobbyists in Washington, D.C. at the time. And it was unusual for him to be a conservative and be a lobbyist.
Right, right. So just before you go on, and I want to hear more of that story, I'm curious to give our listeners some sense of context. Abramoff is like this top lobbyist, or you were working for his firm. Use either example you like, but what kind of money are these guys making? What kind of world is that?
Yeah, no, I think...
I mean, if you want to share how much you were making or Jack was making, you know, feel free, you know, whatever you want to share.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how much he was making, but I'm sure it was around $1 million a year.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And so the allure for a staffer on the Hill who, you know, usually comes to Washington and is an ideologue, you know, cares about policy, wants to do well and, you know, sort of change the world. And then in my case, I was a good example. Then I met a woman who I wanted to marry and start a family. And I'd been on the Hill for 7.5 years and went to law school and decided now I've got to make some money to support a family. What's the next step? Being a congressional staffer, the skill set doesn't transfer to too many different places. The people who want you the most are all the businesses, nonprofits, and entities around the world that are lobbying the U.S. Congress. They want your contacts and your know-how. And so that's why you see so many people cash out and become lobbyists. So for somebody like me, if I'm on the Hill and I'm making, you know, just shy of $100,000 at the time, to go be a lobbyist, I can make $200,000 overnight, and usually more than that. And so by the end of my, sort of before my downfall, by the year, you know, 2005, I'm making $500,000 a year.
Okay, and just looked up Jack Abramoff's net worth. According to CelebrityNetWorth.com, which I don't know about the accuracy, I won't vouch for it, but they say his net worth is $44 million. Okay, so, you know, he's doing pretty well. I mean, my real estate company has some celebrity clients, and according to the same website, their net worth isn't that high. So that's a pretty big deal for a lobbyist, definitely.
Well, in his case, he had to pay, they might have evaluated that because he had to pay something like $30 million in restitution to
wow.
people he had defrauded.
Yeah.
Okay. So I don't think he has that kind of money.
So but, 14 million still ain't bad. And just to put that in context for the listeners, they say that Janet Yellen, our current Federal Reserve Chair, which I really doubt this, by the way, is one of the wealthiest or the wealthiest Federal Reserve Chair. And when she went in, according to what I heard, her net worth was $13 million, which really isn't that big a deal in the world of the wealthy. But yeah, it's interesting. So if Jack is still worth $14 million, he's ahead of Janet Yellen. I just wanted to give some context there for what
it's worth. Yeah. And one thing that raises, though, and I saw this, is there's a lot of, you know, they say the Senate is the millionaires club. There's a lot of rich members of Congress. But there are some that aren't. And what's funny is you see staffers working for a member who maybe makes $200,000 a year. That's their public salary. And all of a sudden, the staffer is making twice that just for knowing the member. It's just a strange system. I don't know that there's a way to necessarily fix that through law, but it sets up some odd relationships and some odd dynamics.
Yeah, it certainly does. So what happened to you? Tell us the story of how you ended up going to prison.
Yeah, so I was a lobbyist. I was trained by Jack Abramoff and the guys I knew from his team who had worked on them. Those were the guys I knew from working on the Hill. They were the ones who recruited me. I didn't really know Jack that well. And so I became a lobbyist. I didn't even know what that meant. I moved to a firm called Preston Gates, and I began lobbying, which is basically acting like staff, but just doing it downtown. You're representing companies, and you're trying to get members of Congress to support policies that your clients support. And so sometimes it's very consistent with what they support, and you're just trying to get them to become more active. So, for instance, some members of Congress wanted to raise taxes on Indian enterprises. Well, our clients were a bunch of Native American tribes who didn't want their businesses taxed. And so we were able to beat that back by appealing to conservatives who didn't like tax increases. We're just showing them that if their philosophy was going to be consistent, they should oppose this as well. And so sometimes it's really just getting somebody who's already agreed with you to be more active in that position. And so that's what I did. And part of lobbying at the time, what was very commonplace was, and this will be no surprise, was wining and dining. So we would take people to lunch, or, you know, friends of mine who worked on the Hill, we'd go to dinner, or our wives would come, and it would be a way to socialize. And so you're not always asking for things. You had the ability to take people out. And the rules of the House and Senate allowed for that. You also could take people out to sporting events or concerts. And so we did all of those things. And they say that Abramoff used to have an expression, anything worth doing is worth overdoing. And so while everybody wined and dined and took people to events, I think our team was known for having more tickets to more events and doing more of that than anybody else. We were a big hospitality firm. And when Abramoff got in trouble because of some side ventures he was involved in, he was doing some grassroots business, and it was thought that he was defrauding clients not related to our lobbying. An investigation occurred. And once the investigation started, the FBI then turned and looked at relationships between Abramoff's lobbying team and members of Congress, because it's hard to sort of get your nose under that tent if you're the FBI, unless you have some cause. And now they did, because they had a lobbyist in their crosshairs. So they started investigating. And what they saw and found, though not different than most firms did, they didn't like. And understandably, people don't like the idea of the staffers and members getting free things. They began their investigation, and they at some point came to me and said, we think that you are, by giving these things and benefits to your former congressman, the man you used to work for, you're bribing his office. And I cooperated for 2 years, telling them everything I knew about everybody I had lobbied and worked with. But at the end of the day, they said, we want you to plead guilty to essentially bribing these members of Congress and their staffs. And I couldn't say it because I didn't believe that. And so it led to a standoff, and they were not happy that I wasn't cooperating. And so it started a series of events. They raided the house. The FBI raided my house one morning, and then they came and arrested me a couple months later, and I went to trial. In the first trial, I had a hung jury, evenly divided, because the jury believed that I was doing what other lobbyists do. Most people thought that was going to be the end of it. But the government said, we'll try him as many times as we have to. So they tried me a second time. They got a conviction on half the counts. And I was ultimately sentenced to 20 months in prison. And I appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, but lost. And so I ended up spending 15 and a half months in federal prison in Maryland, and I just got out 4 months ago.
Wow, that's amazing. So how much influence, I guess I'll say in quotes, did you exert over these, were they senators? Or who were they specifically?
Yeah, it was senators, members of the House, okay. But mostly their staff.
Yeah, oh, it's not directly them. It's the staffers that you sort of influenced.
Sometimes it is if you have a special relationship. So, for instance, I worked for a couple different members of Congress. When I left the Hill, I remained friendly with them. And now that I was on the outside, I still thought of myself as still trying to be helpful to them. So I would raise money for them from my clients and from others. I would donate to them because I still believed in them. And so you have these relationships that you've built up honestly over time, having worked together in the trenches. And then when you go lobby, these are the people you know are the people you usually turn to. Yeah. People will say, hey, if I can be helpful in any way, you know, I will do that. And you have the experience of having worked on the Hill. So sometimes when you're a lobbyist and now your question about how much influence you have, I think you have influence because of two things. One is you have a lot of expertise because you've already done that. You've been on the Hill. You know how the process works, and you can be assistant to staff. And the second thing is you have financial support. You have contributions, and you have political support that members want because they all want to get reelected.
Sure.
And so you can say, look, I need your help, and if you can be helpful, it's good for you.
Okay, so that's good to know. But in terms of taking them to sporting events and dinners, wining and dining them, how much money was involved? What did they get you for? Was it a $100 dinner, or was it season tickets that cost $30,000? You know, like, what's the...
Well, it varied based on who they thought I had bribed, but on some people, they thought the bribe was giving somebody tickets to, like, Disney on Ice to go with his family, or to the Wiggles, you know, the children's entertainers. They said that a bribe could be as little as $5 so long it was given and taken with corrupt intent.
Yeah. I got that they can get you on $5, but how much was it in your case?
Yeah. Oh, in my case, it depended on who the staffer was that they said I had bribed. But in some offices, for instance, I had taken people to, say, 10 dinners over the course of a year. It may be $1,000, $2,000.
Okay.
Or given them tickets that had face value, though you wouldn't get it, the face value was $400 or $500. And so they said that people then took official acts because of those things. It's a good question because fundamentally that's why I couldn't plead, is because I know people are motivated by all sorts of reasons, and I know people want to get reelected, and some members respond to campaign contributions. I never found a staffer did something or didn't do something because I gave them tickets or took them to lunch.
That's fine, but how much did you spend on these people? That's what the listeners want to know. Did you spend, say, a total of $20,000 with all the people that they claim you were influencing improperly?
Oh, yeah. Over the course of 4 years, I think they said I spent $100,000.
Okay, so $100,000, so $25,000 a year, basically, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
But if you spent $5 in 4 years, you could have been convicted just the same, right? Technically.
Sure, if they thought the intent was corrupt, yeah.
Okay, so that's what happened to you. And I had Bernard Carrick on the show recently. He talked about him going to prison too. And the reason I want to do some shows on this concept is that it is very disconcerting to me that we have something I have dubbed the government prison industrial complex. Because prison has become a profit center. As a person with libertarian leanings, when I first heard about privatizing prisons many years ago, I thought, well, you know, that's a good idea. Private companies will manage it much better than the government does, of course, because the government's massively corrupt and inefficient and terrible at almost everything. but it doesn't work. I was wrong about that. It's a terrible idea, I think. You should never have a profit incentive to imprison people or do anything bad to people, you know, including war, because, you know, the military industrial complex obviously has that problem. But tell us about the mandatory minimum sentencing. This is absurd, Kevin, that we have the highest incarceration rate in the world in this country, the land of the free. This is incredible. There are so many laws. I had John Stossel on the show. He's done some excellent shows on this himself on his own program. You cannot possibly know all the laws. I had the author of Three Felonies a Day on the show before.
Harvey Silverly.
You know Harvey. And we are all criminals. We now live in a society where everybody is a criminal. And what that does is that it always gives the government a position, especially with the NSA eavesdropping now, where they always have something on you. There's always something. If they want to get you, they can get any of us. It is insane. I mean, this is scary. I wonder if it's more scary to live in the good old US of A than maybe it is to live in a country you view as more corrupt and less free. North Korea doesn't have this many people on a per capita basis in prison. And look at North Korea. Well, my God, that country is very scary.
Yes, I don't think I'd choose North Korea, but I get the point.
Neither would but, you know, just saying.
It used to be that if a crime was committed and you found a criminal who committed it, and the danger we have now is once the government decides you're a criminal, they can find a crime to pin on you. And so let me give you an example. This subway guy, because he's in the news, this Jared Fogel, who did some bad things. When they raided his house, though, you know, a couple months ago or whatever it was, I said it's over for him. I mean, because that's the level we're at. Once the government decides needs to find something for you, they're going to find something for you because we have now over 4,000 federal criminal laws. They don't even know how many we have. They haven't even counted them. And there's so much discretion. And so, for instance, the statute that I was convicted of, I call it bribery because it's hard to tell people what it is. It's really an honest services fraud statute. It's a wired mail fraud statute, and it says whoever deprives another person of that person's honest services. So, I mean, you could go to a baseball game, and the vendor charges you $6 for a soda that you know outside the stadium is $2, and you could say you're ripping these people off because that's not how much it should cost. I mean, it's so elastic, and so many of the laws today are so poorly written and broad, and they give prosecutors the discretion to charge what they want. And yes, we have a jury system, so it still has to pass that. But once you're sitting in the dock and the United States government is standing up there saying this person did something wrong, and indeed, you may think the person did something ethically questionable, but whether it was, you know, criminally prohibited, that's a different question, but sometimes a jury won't even navigate that difference. It's a scary proposition. We do have more prisoners than China, than Russia, than any impressive regime you can think of. And I think people realize there's something wrong with that. And it used to be, I don't know how you feel about this, when I grew up, I thought, I didn't know anybody who went to jail. And now I look around, and I think everybody knows somebody who went to prison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just seems like a totally different world in which, even for me, and I worry about the impact on my children, it's not so different. Because when I went to prison and I told
I want to just stop you there. You know what? I never thought of that, and that is true. Until recently, maybe I just know more people now, or maybe I'm hanging around out with the wrong crowd. I hope not. I hope that's not the case, because I definitely believe in strategically choosing one's associations, okay? But, you know, for example, there's a mastermind group I'm in. It's a big group, okay? It's like 100 people, okay? But two of the people in that group have gone to prison. And I don't know them very well, but I just heard them speak in front of the group and tell a little bit about their story. And they, you know, it was all like white collar type stuff, you know, disobeying some obscure law that they didn't even know existed. To give balance to this statement, I'm sure everybody in prison is not guilty, as they say, right? Everybody's innocent, right?
Right, right, right.
You know,
but
it's not a matter of being technically guilty or innocent, really. It's a matter of, you know, is the law ethical in the first place? Just to give context to that, I mean, there are all kinds of ridiculous laws, of course, nowadays, but think of simple things from the olden days. Think of Rosa Parks. It was the law that you had to sit on the back of the bus if you were black, okay? And I mean, that's absurd. There are all kinds of unjust laws throughout history, okay?
No, that's right. And it's almost as if sometimes people should look at what's happening with our incarceration rate and our sort of police state and think, well, maybe if we want the laws respected, the laws need to be more respectable. Because if we're locking up 1 in 100 adults, then maybe we've gone too far in what we're prohibiting, or at least in what we're subjecting to prison. which is to say, you can punish people in all sorts of ways. We don't have to lock everybody in cages. Mm-hmm. And maybe we should save that expensive punishment for people we're really scared of instead of those we're just mad at.
Yeah, there are certainly some barbaric criminals out there who need to be locked up.
Yes. So I think that's another distinction. But the whole theory of three felonies a day and all the rest, I think that's a real concern. And I do think that's when people say, how's this changed? Why are people suddenly caring about this? I think it's because it's not a foreign thing anymore. It's not, that's the other that happens to somebody else. People know now in their families, and they're starting to say, come forward. And I think that's how you change the culture.
Yeah. Tell us about the mandatory minimum sentences.
Into that. This is the worst of the worst. Because not only do you have vague laws and you have zealous prosecutors, when they have mandatory minimum statutes, which are laws that basically say, if this one factor is met, you get a certain set penalty in prison. So it may be if you're dealing in a certain drug, if they find 5 grams, you get 5 years automatically. It doesn't matter your role. It doesn't matter your record. It doesn't matter anything else. Whatever the context is can be ignored. If there's a certain threshold amount or factor, we can apply a mandatory minimum. That gives prosecutors even more control over the process because now the judge is cut out of it. A judge could sit through a trial and say, yeah, technically he violated this and he did this, but I think it's because he's got an addiction, or I think it's because this girl was, sort of forced into this by an abusive spouse or a boyfriend, and that's why she was involved in this. There may be other extenuating circumstances that don't make this penalty that Congress wrote years ago fit this particular crime. Well, with a mandatory minimum, they can't do that. And so it gives the prosecutor this extraordinary leverage to go to somebody and say, if you don't plead guilty and tell us everything you know about everything, we're going to hammer you with a 5, 10, 20-year mandatory minimum sentence. And the result of that is we now resolve 97% of our criminal cases through plea deals.
Yeah, right.
We have
right,
the constitutional
exactly.
right to trial. But if they're gone in practice, yeah. No one goes to trial
right,
anymore.
Right, right. Yeah, the plea amount because it's efficient.
Yeah, I went to trial. I had friends, good law-abiding people, total salt of the earth, worked on Capitol Hill, patriotic people saying, I believe you're innocent, but just take the deal. Just say you did it.
Right.
And I thought, what have we come to that's happening?
Think about this. If you don't take a plea deal, you're literally risking your life. Okay, because number one, prisons are a dangerous place, obviously. But number two is that your opponent, the government, has unlimited resources in terms of time, money, staff. You know, the old saying, you can't fight City Hall. It is insane.
Let me tell you that specifically because I think it helps. And I always hear people say, oh, you can't afford to go to trial. Let me tell you specifically. I cooperated for 2 years. I went to trial. And I had spent $1 million. And when I hung the jury and we thought, okay, this might be the end of it, and they said, we'll try you 10 times if we have to, because it becomes personal for them. I was done. I then had to have my lawyers got appointed as public defenders and were allowed to stay on the case so I didn't have to get new people who came up to speed, which would have cost taxpayers more. But overall, I rang up $2 million in bills. I mean, I'm in debt now for as long as, I can live, probably.
Wow, yeah.
And so when people say, oh, it's expensive, it's true, but I don't want to leave it that general. It is incredibly expensive. The only ones you see, are like former Vice President John Edwards, you see Roger Clemens went, otherwise you don't go to trial. And it's because it's not just expensive, it's ruinous. If you win, you still feel like you lost because now you're out of money. You don't get your money back.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. It's not like you have an attorney's fees clause and you can recover your money. It seems like the public fervor over this let's be tough on crime mantra has died down a bit, fortunately, because I think people have seen how that ideology is backfiring. I used to completely agree with it, and I remember years ago in California when the talk was all about the three strikes law, and I used to agree with that idea too, but now I don't think so. Let me just share a couple of things about this and have you comment on them. Number one, you talked about plea deals. I have a friend, a good friend, who works for the DA's office in Orange County, California. I was asking about how things work and what happens this crime and that crime. It's always interesting to know a DA, right? And basically, the deal is it's just a standard course of practice, what the plea offer is for a given crime. And part of the plea deal is always you have to supply your DNA, we have to take a DNA sample, and it'll be entered into the database. So even if you are accused of some minor offense, they now have your DNA sample. And what they're doing with this is they're using it to convict your family members of things. Okay? And so who knows what that will lead to, right? I mean, it is just, it's Big Brother is watching you. You know, it's 1984. Yeah. It's Orwellian. Okay, so that's one point. And then the other point is on this three strikes concept. I was watching old TV show Burn Notice. You're familiar with this show probably, right? With Michael Weston, yes. The former spy, right? I was watching this the other night, and Weston, in one of the episodes, swims into the beach on his clothing after jumping out of a helicopter to escape someone, right? From his old spy agency or something like that. He jumps out of the helicopter, swims into the beach. He's got his clothing on, not a swimsuit, and he sees a cop, and the cop looks at him funny, like, what are you doing all wet in your clothes? And he runs. So he's committed one crime there, running away from the cop, okay? And then he runs through a little flea market and he grabs a hat. That's another crime because he stole that from one vendor. And then he grabs a pair of sunglasses to disguise himself. That's the third crime. So I don't understand the three strikes law exactly, the 25 to life in prison. But maybe just in that little act, he committed three strikes. I don't know for sure if that's accurate, but it just occurred to me, you know, how easily that could happen. And he may be guilty of nothing at all. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, that is how it can happen. There is a guy in federal prison right now serving 55 years because the feds waited until he made three drug buys. And each time he either had a gun in the car or back at his house even, and that counted as using a weapon in the commission of a felony. And so the mandatory minimum was 5 for the first one, 25 for the second, and 25 for the third. But they waited until they charged them all at once, and they could add them all together. And with the mandatory sentences, he ended up getting 55 years.
Unbelievable.
And, you know, they could have arrested him after the first time, scared the heck out of him, right? Give him a sort of a wake-up indictment and or short jail sentence. And instead, they wait, and they take him away for the rest of his life.
Oh, they wait for the crimes to multiply. That's a strategy. Wow.
Yeah.
And
Yeah. Basically,
what does that do? Like, we got to ask ourselves, what is the government's motivation for this? I mean, there's certainly been some stories about corrupt judges. I think one was in Pennsylvania who was basically sentencing all these juveniles to all this time in prison. And he was being paid off by the company that owned the prison. Basically, they were trying to create more occupancy. I mean, look, I'm in the real estate business, right? If I could basically force people, you know, take away their freedom and force them to occupy my units and my apartments and houses, right? Wouldn't that be a good deal? That's what the prison business is. They can lower their vacancy rate and increase their occupancy rate by bribing judges or by, in your former career, using lobbyists to lobby politicians to make stricter laws so more people will just disobey them.
Yes. Yeah.
This is the most unholy thing.
Yeah, and you asked what the motivation is. I think, and I talked about this with my prosecutor because I thought he's getting very vengeful, he's taking this personally, and he's a government employee. He should be just seeking to do justice.
But the prosecutors want to further their careers, right? So that's certainly
motivation.
But,
you know, right, and they also think, you got to believe they wake up thinking they're doing justice. They're putting away bad guys.
Yeah.
And what comes with that is sort of the zealotry, right, of I'm doing the Lord's work here. I'm putting away bad guys. I mean, I sleep great at night for that reason. And so I think there's good and bad in all of these different fields. And the question is, do we have a system that protects people's liberty? So I don't mind that this prosecutor is aggressive and is doing what he wants. But I want a judge who's independent to be able to check his power.
Yeah.
And that's where the system has to come in and play. And so the problem with mandatory minimums is one example, and a really strong example, is when you cut the judge out, it'd be like letting the prosecutor decide what evidence is admissible. You can't say, oh, well, they know what's best. Let them judge. Let them decide how they want to put on their case. No, no, no. They would stack the deck in their favor. You need a judge who says, no, this would be prejudicial. This would be unfair. And so You need independent people. You can have bad people. Our country's full of bad people, but we need good systems.
Right.
And our justice system right now isn't a good system.
Okay, so let's talk about that for a moment. Let's assume that the prosecutors, they want to further their career. They've got their own ambitions, so they're going to put away innocent people or put them away for longer than they should or more harshly than they should. And that's disgusting enough. And there's this culture in the cop world. I remember when one of my friends was going to the police academy. Now, this was years ago, and this culture, I think, has changed because the police brutality problem is just becoming epic and disgusting, too. But that's another show. I remember, you know, one of the things they told him is that he really wasn't supposed to be hanging around with a lot of cops after work. In other words, you need to be friends with regular people who are not police. I was kind of wondering, like, why is that? Why do they say that, you know? And it was because they don't want them to get this, like, zealotry, like they're above the law or become too brutal. They want them to have, like, regular citizen friends who aren't cops. They don't want them to be too overly immersed in that culture. Now, I doubt that's true nowadays, okay? But who knows? And, you know, the prosecutors are sort of immersed in this culture of, let's just nail everybody, probably, right? I mean, I don't know what the thing is like at the DA's office, but, you know, that may well be the culture there. But the judges, let's talk about the judges for a moment. I mean, what are the judges like? I mean, certainly judges, many of them are elected, you know, not appointed necessarily. And so they've got a career too. Like, what is their platform? Am I tough on crime or am I letting all the bad guys go? What are the judges like?
Well, I think you're right, or at least you pointed to it. It depends. I mean, at the federal level, they're appointed, right, and they have life tenure. And at the states, sometimes they run. They're elected. I think we need to get away from elected judges for exactly that reason. I don't think there has to be somebody who doesn't have skin in the game, whose job is really looking out for justice as dispassionately as possible and can't have in the back of their mind, how is this going to affect my political and financial future? Now, with prosecutors, I don't think there's any way to avoid that. But for judges, there certainly is, and that is to not elect them. So I think on balance, judges turn out to be much more independent and therefore fairer, and I think that's why, you know, you see when they get accused of being soft. But, you know, we have a saying that, you know, we'd rather have one person go free than, you know, anyone stay behind bars who's innocent. Well, it's the same way with sentencing. I'd rather have somebody serve a little shorter sentence than have somebody who didn't really do a lot and get, you know, 50 years in jail, because the default in this country is supposed to be to liberty. And so I want faith community as much as anybody else. But I think judges, especially ones who are appointed, do a better job of finding that balance, because I think you lose yourself when your career is tied up in getting convictions and getting long sentences. That's how prosecutors judge themselves. Did we get 10 years? Did we get 15 years? If you're in their offices, they're pinning those newspaper articles to their bulletin board.
Yeah.
You know, those are pelts, and it's hunting for them, and that's the culture. And I'm not so sure you can change that, because humans are the way they are. But you can change it by fixing the system.
That's true. Give out your website. Tell people what they can do. If people listen to this and they're concerned about their own liberty, the liberty of their family and friends, and just the general direction of our country, which is disconcerting to say the least, you know, what can they do? What actual action can they take?
One thing is they can make sure when they communicate with lawmakers or public officials at any level, that they communicate that being reflexively tough on crime is not enough, that they want people to be smart, use their taxpayer dollars wisely, and meaning don't lock up every single person in the world forever if they're not a threat to you, and that they want laws that have more specificity. You know what I'm saying? They don't want Congress to react to every single incident or the state legislature. Think about this. We have hundreds of laws named after dead victims. Because as soon as tragedy strikes in this country, we think the public wants us to respond with some new criminal law.
Yeah, it's a knee-jerk reaction. But we never seem to repeal any laws. You know, we just make more.
Exactly. And they're written poorly, and then they're used for other things. So you get the Patriot Act being used to go after people that have nothing to do with terrorism. You get the RICO, the racketeering statute, passed to go after the mob, used against abortion protesters. Everything becomes mission creep, and so the government gets more and more tools. And I think you're seeing it now with the militarization of the police. People are saying, we don't need our local police force to have tanks and Uzis and all these things.
Oh, my God, I know. What are they planning to go to war against us? You know, we have a military for this.
But those are the physical tools. And while those are objectionable, we need people to say, you also have too many legal tools. I'm not so scared that you're going to shoot me with your tank. It's that you're going to lock me up with this vague criminal statute that has nothing to do with what I did. So, you know, that's the bigger threat to liberty. So the cause for reform, which is picking up speed really across the country, is, I think, buoyed by that. But that sense that we've gone too far, and that needs to continue. So people just need to support criminal justice reform, be smart about it, don't reflexively give credit to those who say they're going to crack down on crime unless you know exactly what they're planning on doing.
Yeah. So the website is famm.org, and I'm about to make a donation to you myself.
Oh, thank you.
Is this a group you started, or you work for them, right?
I work for them. They've been around since 1991. Julie Stewart, who was at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank in Washington, started this in 1991 after her brother, first-time, low-level, nonviolent offender from a good family, got charged with growing marijuana and got 5 years mandatory minimum. And Julie at the time thought, you know, my brother needed a kick in the butt, but he didn't need 5 years in federal prison. Mm-hmm. And she didn't know that these laws existed. And the judge said, I don't think I should be giving him 5 years. And Julie said, well, then don't. And he said, I don't have a choice. Congress wrote this. And at that point, she said, this has got to change. And so for 24 years, she's been doing this, and I'm glad to be part of it, and it's making a difference now.
Is the donation, is it tax deductible? Is this a 501c3, or what is the status of this group?
Yes, it is. It's 501c3. Donations are tax deductible.
All right. Well, my foundation's going to give you a donation right now. So it's famm.org. What else can people do about this?
You know, talk to their friends. Get smarter about this. Learn the law. People don't know. And, it, you know, we used to have the saying that, you know, ignorance of the law is no excuse. And you see a lot of criminal law experts saying now, well, how can you be ignorant of the law? How can you possibly
you're
know?
You're always ignorant now because everybody, there's too many laws. Nobody can keep track of this.
And you add the regulatory crimes that have been created. You know, so you've got this massive over-criminalization problem. All of our conduct is criminal now. So I think people got to get smarter to protect themselves, but they also got to get smarter about how bad this problem is. Talk to their friends, talk to their neighbors. And the other thing is, I try not to hide the fact that I serve prison time. And my kids don't love this, right? Mm-hmm. And especially if they're at the wrong age. But I don't want there to be a stigma. You know, if I had murdered somebody or raped somebody, I get it. But I think for people who are nonviolent offenders and spent prison time, the reaction I get more is, what a waste. And I think, you're right. And so they're better off for having known my case. And I want people to know more about that. I hope that people would just be more open about their experience with the criminal justice system. So we realize that things happen that we don't want to happen. And it happens to people we know now. And that's a problem.
Yeah, right. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us and telling us about this important problem. You know, nobody's really paying attention to it until it affects them or someone they care about. It needs to be talked about more often. Keep up the good work. That's Kevin Ring, the website famm.org. We'll talk to you soon, Kevin.
Okay, thanks so much.
Thank you for joining us today for the Holistic Survival Show, protecting the people, places, and profits you care about in uncertain times. Be sure to listen to our Creating Wealth Show, which focuses on exploiting the financial and wealth creation opportunities in today's economy. Learn more at www.jasonhartman.com or search Jason Hartman on iTunes. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, offering very general guidelines and information. Opinions of guests are their own, and none of the content should be considered individual advice. If you require personalized advice, please consult an appropriate professional. Information deemed reliable, but not guaranteed. This show is produced by the Hartman Media Company, all rights reserved. For distribution or publication rights and media interviews, please visit www.hartmanmedia.com or email media@hartmanmedia.com. Nothing on this show should be considered specific personal or professional advice. Please consult an appropriate tax, legal, real estate, or business professional for individualized advice. Opinions of guests are their own, and the host is acting on behalf of Platinum Properties Investor Network, Inc., exclusively.